800 Progressive.
And you are listening to WMNF in Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And, excuse me, and I'm Arlene Engelhardt, and you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. You know, you want to start your day with WMNF. The WMNF Morning Show gives you eclectic music from all eras and news updates from NPR and the WMNF News Team. 6 a.m. to 9 a.m., the Morning Show, WMNF 88.5, the last local radio station in Tampa Bay. And I also want to say that I'm so sad about the loss of our health programmer, Eve Prang Plews, and we send out condolences to her family and friends and to all the listeners who enjoyed her every other week.
She was a very unique person who gave so generously of her time, her wisdom, her knowledge, her humor. She will really be missed. MNF is so lucky to have people like that that give so much time, gave so much time. And it's the special meaning of community. And so we have to keep it going here. You know, it used to be that I would kind of look upon the show as kind of that was the week that was or the week to be. And now it's almost that this is the hour or the minute, you know, that everything changes. And so, anyway, with that in mind, we're looking at Brett Kavanaugh. And to me, it is absolutely imperative that we keep that man off the Supreme Court. And we're going to be talking in just a few moments to Marge Baker from People for the American Way. And she's going to be giving us an analysis of what's happening. And then, you know, thinking of the Supreme Court and thinking, you know, the difference between a Kennedy and his votes. And I'm thinking about the environmental case, Massachusetts versus, I can't remember what that court case was totally. But actually, with Kennedy's swing vote, that indeed they said that the EPA could regulate air pollution and substances in the air. And what a difference of last year's court with Gorsuch on there, and we'll probably be talking about some of that. So anyway, fasten your seat. Oh, Arlene, sorry,
well,
go ahead.
Let me go ahead and give a phone number right now, too. If you'd like to call your senator or any senator about either of these issues, I understand that Senator Nelson has not committed yet on Kavanaugh.
Yes, you're exactly right.
How he's going to vote. The phone number you can reach all senators and just need to give their name is 202-224-2121, 202-224-2121.
I'm going to put this music on, and without further ado, because we've got a lot to cover today, I'm going to get in touch with Marge Baker. Down because I'm really happy to have on the phone with us right now Marge Baker, and she is the Executive Vice President for People for the American Way. She's the Chief Strategist. She oversees policy work to confirm fair-minded judges to the federal judiciary. She's also led organizational work for anti-corruption efforts and campaigns to reduce undue influence of money in politics. So, Marge Baker, welcome so much to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, have you been following the hearings? I imagine you have. with Brett Kavanaugh?
I've actually been in the hearing room every day. In fact, I stepped out of the hearing room in order to get on the phone with you.
Oh, well, I really hate to take your time. No problem at all.
This is important because this is all about constituents of senators understanding what's at stake here. So absolutely happy to be on this call.
Oh, well, I am so happy to have you because I spent a lot of time on your website, People for the American Way, founded by Norman Lear and Barbara Jordan. And
yes.
I think we have never needed the attitudes of those two people much more. And I'm getting so frustrated because we've done quite a few programs on Brett Kavanaugh, some of his policies, et cetera, and his extensive political career in so many ways. And somehow to hear his answers, when they're asking him direct questions, he says, well, that's hypothetical, and I'm not going to answer that. And in a way, to me, kind of ever since Bork, this has been kind of the way these appointments, they just don't give any answers, and it's really frustrating when you think of how important this, appointment is. And to hear some of his answers, I found I had to stop watching.
Well, you raise a really good point. I think this is a totally not business as usual situation, so... Because, as you indicate, the stakes are so very high on so many issues that affect our daily lives, from reproductive freedom to Affordable Care Act protections to whether or not you're going to have an independent check on the president. So the stakes are enormous. And the other thing is, this process has been so corrupt from day one in terms of compiling a list of pre-vetted ultra-conservative nominees who pass the president's litmus test on choice, on ACA, who are being nominated by a president under investigation, and Kavanaugh is the one nominee of all of the list who has the absolute worst record in terms of being an independent check on presidential power. So you put all that together. So Kavanaugh's failure to answer questions means that he's not rebutting any of the presumption that he went into this hearing with, that he won't be open-minded and he won't be fair-minded. So that's number one. And number two, we just found out, and I actually have not had a chance to read the email, but the New York Times just broke a story. One of the documents that was released that had been being kept confidential and it got released and leaked to the New York Times apparently indicates that Kavanaugh challenged in this email whether Roe v. Wade was settled law. That was the way to describe it. So that's huge, right?
Yeah.
Here's somebody who's claiming, using the, well, it's settled law, and we have apparently an email that had been being kept confidential for no clear reason by this corrupt process that Senator Grassley, the chair of the committee, created, that seems to put that in doubt. So even his statement that Roe is settled law. So this is not business as usual. This is not normal circumstances. This is it's unlike any Supreme Court nomination hearing or process that I've been part of, and I've been through a number of them.
Well, and you just brought up the documents, and to me that's so important because this man does have such an extensive background in politics and working with presidents, et cetera. And, when the National Archives said that they could not get all this back until, late October, and, that they won over 100,000 documents and then the dump the night before, which, quotes, the majority had read them, or I don't know, they said they had them all read by the next morning at 9, and, that whether there is something to hide or not, but the point is, it gives such an implication. And to tell you the truth, I'm still concerned about the last time he was confirmed for a judgeship in 2006, that he, in fact, perhaps lied, to lay others about his involvement in torture or wireless wiretapping, et cetera. And, one has every reason to think that some of the material in those documents might lend credence to that. And to me, that's a very serious thing, to lie under oath. And this was back in 2006. And so, at this moment, as you said, there we have that op-ed in the New York Times yesterday, that says, hey, we've got a very inept person and we're trying to keep the things going here, kind of an open rebellion, if you will. I mean, these are anything but normal times. And
anything but normal times and times when you really want somebody that you have confidence is going to be open-minded and is not bringing a political agenda to the court. And sadly, that is not Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh is not open-minded. He's not going to bring an open-minded case. He's coming with a political agenda to undo rights and liberties that we care deeply about. And he's coming with a history of believing that the president is above the law, has unchecked power. And that, in these times, is very, very dangerous.
Well, tell you the truth, I think that's dangerous at any time. I mean, really. I mean, if you want to have...
Exactly, yes. Well said, yes.
Yeah, if you want to have a democracy, you've got to have a president that follows the law, too, or what's it about?
And absolutely.
And, you know, I have people I know up there that are protesting, et cetera. I don't think any of them have been arrested yet. But just the fact that, what, 70 the first day were arrested, and I think almost the same number yesterday, that you've probably sat in on other confirmation hearings, that just this kind of energy in that courtroom, and to have Grassley, you know, sitting there, and Kamala Harris is trying to say, you know, this is like a discovery process, and we have not had time to read this, and Grassley's talking over her. I mean, it would be a charade, except I know that they have the majority of votes, and so I'd like your reflection, because as I understand it, before you went with the People for the American Way, that actually you were the chief strategist, or you were with Paul Wellstone.
That's correct, yes.
And to me, the difference between a Paul Wellstone's approach to politics in this country and one's sense of dedication, and what we're seeing now, you must feel you're almost in different worlds.
Well, in different worlds, although I have to say, the energy that the Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee have brought to this fight is very, very, very impressive. They get the stakes. They understand what's at stake. I think they're horrified at the corrupt process that's been used throughout this whole nominations process. They were horrified at the, you know, blockade of Merrick Garland's nomination. So there's energy clearly among the audience and among those who are in the public, and there's energy among the senators on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and energy among senators off the committee. I think there's 3 or 4 press conferences today by senators off the committee dealing with various issues having to do with the environment and choice and a whole number of issues. So it's different than any hearing I've ever seen. And I appreciate your mentioning Paul, because I actually feel the spirit of Paul Wilson in this room right now, and that's what we need.
Well, and again, we're talking to Marge Baker, and she's the Executive Vice President of People for the American Way, and her particular interest is trying to put competent judges on the federal judiciary. And, you know, I really strongly recommend to the listeners that they go to your website, because you have such an excellent analysis of some of the cases. And I was kind of horrified when I was going through some of the cases that when Kennedy was on court, that, you know, he was at 5-4 majority. But just last year, some of the cases that were decided, which were so important to our people, with Gorsuch, that to me, it's almost frightening to think that you would add Kavanaugh to Gorsuch to Thomas. So many times that Gorsuch and Thomas gave the implication that they would much rather go much further, you know, than Roberts and Alito were allowing them. And, you know, things like to any person, you know, to me it's really important right now, all these arbitration clauses that people are forced to sign to take a job. And now that's really taking away a basic right, because not only do you have to have enforced arbitration, but you do not and have the right for collective action.
That's right.
And then I think it was the one, I don't know, it was Pavin versus Smith or something like that. I can't remember all the names. But that, you know, they said, well, that, you know, that actually a state might have to recognize gay marriage, but it doesn't mean they can't take reasonable limitations to it. And I thought, my God, this is Roe versus Wade attacks. I mean, in other words, it was stunning to me that in just a year, and I really strongly recommend that the listeners go to that website and you check some of those cases. And if that doesn't send your hair on end, I don't know quite what will.
No, that's exactly right. You're describing, you know, a 5-4 court with Kennedy on it. Kavanaugh, by all independent analyses, is the only justice on the court who is slightly more conservative than he is Justice Thomas. So he's more to the right than Gorsuch, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, calling, for example, Roberts a swing vote is not doing is ridiculous. Roberts not going to be a swing vote. You're going to have a solid, solid, ultra-conservative 5-person majority on the Supreme Court that is going to be able to do horrendous, horrendous damage to everyone, all of our rights and liberties. And if they don't overturn a case, they will clearly gut it to death, right?
Yeah.
So there's so many ways in which they can really seriously undermine our individual liberties, undermine, you know, programs that we depend on for our health and well-being, And it's very frightening, not to mention, and again, and you're absolutely right, it is for presidencies to come, not having a court that will be a check on abuse of executive power.
Yeah, and to me, it's kind of a challenge. To me, it really totally represents a roadblock to democracy. You know, whether yes. you have a doctrine, they look upon the Constitution as, to me, it's almost a religious approach to this. That, you know, when do you say that no longer can people interpret the prophet or whatever? You know, that, okay, now it's been done and now it's just, you know, this. And to me, that to take an originalist, approach, when women aren't even mentioned in the Constitution,
right.
and
right.
then and they not only challenged Roe versus Wade, but they challenged the right that it even should have been considered, you know, and I thought, well, now I don't understand if quote, abortion isn't even mentioned, or women, number one, to start with, then how could you possibly have agreed to something like Citizens United? You know, to me, it really sounds, but rather than a living doctrine, you know, that like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and others, and you kind of think, and I'm not a lawyer, but I know if the Constitution, the original writing, hadn't added the Bill of Rights, I don't think it ever would have been passed.
Right. I mean, we've talked about wanting somebody who's a fair-minded constitutionalist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who understands the impact of the law and the Constitution on the lives of all Americans. And what you have, just to name a couple of examples, in Kavanaugh is somebody who wants to gut even more of the last vestiges of campaign finance regulation. So remove. It is clear from his record that he does not believe that contribution limits to candidates are constitutional. So you're going to see the court probably go even further in dismantling any kind of reasonable regulation of all of this money in politics. And on consumer issues, on the D.C. Circuit, he dissented in two really important consumer cases. He dissented and believes that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that Senator Warren was so instrumental in creating and that has saved consumers, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars is unconstitutional. And he said that the FCC's net neutrality law, which is a democratization of the web, right, was unconstitutional. So, and used the First Amendment of all things to argue that. We have a report on our site. You can go there, www.pfaw.org, which details all of Kavanaugh's 61 dissents. He dissented more than any other active judge on the court. His per years of service, his dissent rate is higher than any judge on the D.C. Circuit. And he routinely decides in favor of corporations, the powerful, the wealthy, against women, workers, consumers. It's just across the board. So it's not just a one-off. This is like consistent record of ruling for the rich, for the powerful, for corporations, for those who want to trample on people's civil rights against, you know, all of us who want to enforce those rights in order to enhance the quality of our lives.
Yeah, and I was really, and again, we're talking to Marge Baker, Executive Vice President for People for the American Way. And if you really want to know a lot more about these cases, and they give very nice brief summaries. You don't have to be a lawyer to understand it. And you do need to understand what the stakes are. And I really was disgusted, you know, when I was reading that. He agreed with Rehnquist, who dissented with Roe versus Wade.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, I think even more, I really got upset because I don't know whether it's for real, but he has this adulation of Scalia. And he said he was just fascinated by the dissents of Scalia. And he really wants to have a time when all of the dissents by Scalia are law. And I thought,
right.
Wow. I mean, you know, Scalia might have had a great sense of humor, but he really was a channeler, really, I mean, of the ghost. And these kind of people, frankly, I don't care what kind of a sense of humor have, they scare me, you know, because that puts them in a special elite. And again, I say that democracy, to me, has to have a living constitution based on law and justice and equality. And to me, the prospect of those three, add Thomas to Gorsuch, and then with Roberson Alito, and, you know, I'm wondering, will they go back with Brown versus Board of Education? Will they go back with Plessy versus Ferguson? I mean, to me, that if you open the floodgates, they would get very creative, I think, almost, in things they could challenge.
I think that's right. I think virtually nothing is off the table, and that's really scary. It's really scary.
Well, it is. And you know, just with the protests, and so many of them have been women, and I've really been trying to watch, and I think some of it's been very humorous, et cetera. But here you've got people that are really trying, and they're getting informed. And, you know, that as I understand it, the process this week is that today he's supposed to be talking mainly, and then at the end of this week, will they have the vote to get out of the committee?
Yeah, they're anticipating another day of his answering questions, although when I left the hearing room, that process is being delayed because there's a huge argument, again, about the withholding of documents. So theoretically, this is the last day of questioning of Kavanaugh, then the plan would be for tomorrow for there to be outside witnesses, both for and against Kavanaugh. Then it will be put on the committee agenda for the September 13th, at least that's the current plan, and then held over a week until September 20th. So the vote could be on the 20th, but I wouldn't necessarily count on that because I think the Democrats are raising significant arguments about not going forward with the inadequacy of the record they have. And so far, Grassley is just, you know, gaveling that down. But at some point, one would think that the public pressure might be too great. And that's actually what's most important right now, is to put pressure on the Senate leadership, on the Republican Senate leadership, about the corruptness of this process and how it doesn't serve the American people.
Well, that's just what I was wondering, because, you know, what can the... Because I think the matter of the documents is really, really important. We have a right to know what he has written, you know, so we have an idea of his mind, because he won't give us any opening to his mind. And so I know the people have been demonstrating inside, outside. What can people do, number one, about the documents, and then number two, if he does get voted out of the committee, what can they continue to do, you know, to try and... Yeah, what can they do?
Right. So let me give you that answer, and then unfortunately I'm going to have to run. So the right now, calls into Senator Grassley's office, frankly. Contacts into Senator Grassley's office. He's the chairman of the committee, senator from Iowa. You don't have to be from Iowa. Anybody should be flooding his office with for a demand that the hearings be halted until the documents issue is resolved. But clearly, the committee hearings have to be halted. So calls right now to Senator Grassley would be immensely important. If it goes forward, if it gets out of committee, the most important thing it's focused on is there's two senators who make the difference on this, who are pro-choice senators and pro-ACA senators, Republican senators, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Susan Collins from Maine. They need to hear from people. They need to hear from people in their state. So I know y'all probably aren't, many of your constituents, clearly your listeners don't live in that state, but you know people there. Anything you can do to you know, your relative, your aunt, your cousin, your best friend's friend, who live in Alaska or Maine, need to get on the phone to Senator Murkowski, Senator Collins, and let them know how strongly they feel that Kavanaugh really will threaten both their reproductive freedom rights and also their potential access to affordable health care.
Well, Marge Baker, I know how busy you are. You get back into the hearing room. I thank you so much for giving us this time. I know it wasn't easy. And keep up the good fight. Marge Baker from the Executive Vice President, People for the American Way. Go to their website, find out some of those cases because you need to know them. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Kind of frightening stuff, really, isn't it, Arlene?
It certainly is. And, you know, it's really, really important to follow through on what she said. First of all, to call Senator Grassley, and you can reach any senator by calling 202-224-3121 and ask the switchboard to connect you with that senator's office. And in the case of Senator Grassley, point out that you want them to halt the hearings until the documents that are being requested have been released and there is time to review them. And then in addition, we need to call Senator Nelson in this state since he has not announced a commitment to vote against Kavanaugh. And then probably the two most important other uncommitted senators are Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. But there are a total of 9 other than Nelson that are not committed, and that includes Doug Jones of Alabama, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Joe Munchen of West Virginia, Jeff Flake of Arizona, Claire McCaskill of Maryland or Missouri, and John Tester of Montana. And I've posted that list on our Facebook page and hope that you will share it with people you know in those areas. I've also heard that there's not a lot of attention being paid to where people that are calling are from, so you might want to call any or all of those senators yourself.
Yeah, and I just want to bring attention to some of the cases just under Gorsuch, you know, that we mentioned just a few of them. And one, I think, I mean, they all really apply. Epic Systems versus Lewis. And this is where, you know, people are forced to sign, you know, to get a job, forced arbitration, and they are prevented from class actions. Janus versus AFSCME. And this really prevents effective collective bargaining. That was decided not too long ago. And Encino Motor Cars versus Navarro. And as you know, a lot of companies now, they actually put people in administrative positions, quotes, that really essentially do the same work that they've been doing. But because of that, then they're no longer allowed to get overtime pay. And so then Gorsuch and others said that's fine. Trinity Lutheran versus Paley. And this was a battle about parking lots that this administration or the state was doing, you know, for the public schools. And they sued and they got the right also to have their parking lot paved. But if you want to really get kind of chilled, you should read the dissent that both Gorsuch and Thomas wrote on that, saying that they really wanted to go much further in the allocation of funds versus, you know, private schools and public schools. Masterpiece Cake Shop, probably most of you remember that. We discussed that actually with Jessica. Mason Piccolo, and this Pavin versus Smith. This was actually a case in a matter of both who could be on the birth certificate of a child, and they ruled that you know, that with a gay couple, that both names were not to be on the certificate. And this is where they said, actually, that the state might recognize marriage, but they do not have to give equal treatment under this marriage. If the state can devise some rational reason for discriminatory treatment, and this is Roe versus Wade personified. I mean, this is that, well, we might recognize it, but we can challenge it. We're rational reasoning. This is a really, really serious path. And NIFLA versus Becerra, and that struck down a California law for disclosure of the crisis pregnancy centers, and this was kind of interesting. If you really want something interesting, read what Stewart said about the whole misuse of freedom of speech, because they said that even though that these people actually give false information at these crisis pregnancy centers, that they could not be forced to tell the true bad data there, because they would then be compelled speech. And this is why Stewart said this gives a whole new meaning to freedom of speech. And Halstead versus A. Philip Randolph Institute, and this was the Ohio vote purge, if you remember. That person hadn't voted, and so they said that was fine. And Jennings versus Rodriguez, and this says it's kind of pretty interesting, because they said, well, even if you know, that the president, you know, has the right to stop immigration and people that they consider threats to society, et cetera, and he has that right to do it, even if it does impact constitutional rights for those people, and it goes on and on. And so no one is exaggerating when I think it said that, you know, that, to me, at least, our democracy is at stake. And so get informed, people, and call and make your voices known, or else you, whether you like it or not, you will have that. And so I'm just really going to quickly get this business here by the station. And so let's give a little listen here.
This is some of what you'll hear on 88.5.
4, 3, 2, 1, Poetry Is.
WMNF Tampa, and we are here from Poetry Is Live. Make some noise, everybody in the audience.
On 88.5, Latin Jazz and Salsa.
And and a very good evening to you. This is WMNF Tampa. You are listening to Surface Noise on the 11th Hour. I am DJ Lounge Laura with a very special show for you tonight.
Good morning. You're listening to the Tuesday morning show on Community Radio WMNF Tampa. I'm Marcy Finkelstein. I'm your Tuesday morning show host, and we've got one more hour left.
If you're a new listener to 88.5, check out our program schedule at WMNF.org.
And again, you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. And yes, the station is very diverse and it does a lot of different things. And Arlene, did you have anything to say?
I just am going to give that phone number one more time. You can call Senator Grassley. You can actually reach Senator Nelson and any of the other senators that are undecided at 202-224-3121. You can go directly to Senator Nelson's office at 202-224-5274. And I did post those names on our Facebook page.
Okay, well, I'm going to put this little music on by Ani DeFranco, because I think indeed we can ask which side are you on. And then we're going to be coming back with Jamie Kittman. And a terrible example that even though a great deal was known about the dangers, the terrible dangers of lead, in which we're very aware right now that we're dealing with it, you know, not only still in some of the paints that on these older homes that the children are being exposed to, but in the water with our plumbing system, et cetera, and poor corrosion control. We've got serious problems, and lead is such a neurotoxin. But how does that get to flame retardants? And I think that when you hear Jamie go through the history of this, that you'll realize, at least in my opinion, how important it is that there are some regulations, that we have government agencies that say, wait a minute, you know, that there's got to be something else involved if you want this product to be exposed to the public other than you're making lots and lots of money. And so think about it. When the Supreme Court, when you have such a pro-corporate and pro-capitalist, you might say, thinking, if Kavanaugh gets on there, I'm not sure lead would have ever been regulated. But it's really kind of horrible things to think about. It's kind of stunning, I think, when you realize. I mean, it's exciting in one way, but in another way, it's kind of troubling. I mean, everything can be different. I don't think we ever want to forget that. That anything we have and we think is really just fundamental truth or a fundamental, you know, kind of agreement with people, and it's been legalized in a type of law, that it all can be changed in an instant. And these are very sobering times. They're dangerous, they're exciting times, and it requires everything that you have in the sense of understanding democracy, understanding what you want in a society, how the importance of your life, and particularly the lives of your neighbors and your community, because that's all at stake now. And we are the only ones that can make a difference, and it's up to the public. I mean, we watch it with, you know, the Senate, and we know the votes are there for the Republicans, and I'm kind of troubled because I think Schumer should get on the stick and make sure that the Democrats are lined up, which they are not at this point, because this is a lifetime appointment. He's only 53. And to me, it's frightening to think what he and Gorsuch and Thomas could push some of the most important laws of our land. So anyway, very serious times, people. Okay, I'm putting this on by Ani DeFranco, and then we will come back with Jamie Kippen.
Our time. Now there's folks in Washington who care what's on our minds. Come on, come on, voters, let's all vote next time. Show me which side are you on now? Which side are you on? Which side are you on now? Which side are you on? Which side are you on now? Which side are you on? Which side are you on now? Which side are you on?
Music down because I'm really excited. With us on the phone is Jamie Kittman, and I really want you to hear this story because to me it really is the reason we need good regulatory apparatus to save us in this country. So Jamie Kittman, who wrote actually an award-winning essay in The Nation, which he in 2000 actually when he traced the whole history of lead. And Jamie, we're going to go through that just a little bit because to me that is so important. And now he's kind of updated it, you might say, and it's kind of sobering, I think, for any of us to think about it, worse than lead. And so, Jamie Kittman, welcome so much to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let me just put you up a little bit so we can hear you. Okay, Jamie. Well, then, you wrote the wonderful article in 2000, award-winning article in The Nation about the history of lead. And so, why did you want to update this now to give us the connection between lead and flame retardants?
Well, that's right. The first piece was, I should backtrack and just say, I'm an automotive journalist. I write about cars. I was always a car buff, and as a car buff, even though I considered myself to be an environmentalist and cared about health and safety, I was, you know, de facto a fan of leaded gasoline, because in the 1970s, when there was discussion of removing lead from gasoline, I believed what I read in magazines and, you know, enthusiast publications saying that if lead came out of the gasoline, it would destroy cars, it would make them, the engines fail quickly, and that their performance would be gone and things like that. So that's what brought me to the subject when I discovered that, in fact, none of that happened, which they sort of filed away. But then when they were taking lead out of gasoline, which happened in the States in the 80s, but it was happening again in Europe in 2000, and I was an editor for an English car magazine and a columnist, and they were saying all the same things, none of which had come to pass in the United States. So I started to research the subject, and I discovered that lead doesn't occur naturally in gasoline, as you might suppose was suggested by the fact that when you pull up to the pump today, it says unleaded. You think, my, somebody has thoughtfully removed lead, the deadly heavy metal, from gasoline. So I thought it was naturally occurring, but in fact I learned upon researching it that it had actually been added to gasoline beginning in the 1920s by a company called the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation, which was founded as a joint venture between General Motors, who, by the way, were controlled at the time by DuPont, its corporate parent, and Standard Oil of New Jersey, a little company we know today as ExxonMobil. And they started adding lead as an additive to gasoline to basically what's called today increase the octane. It would stop engine knock, which was a pervasive problem because gasoline in the 20s, when there were so many cars being sold, suddenly got very crappy. They earned a royalty on every gallon of gasoline for adding that to it. They had patents in the idea of it and the the technology of doing it. That went on for about 45 years.
45?
Yeah. It became ubiquitous around the world. And they, in addition to controlling the distribution and earning this royalty on every gallon of gasoline sold practically everywhere, they controlled all the science that was done. Another thing I didn't know, in the 1920s, the public health community, academics, the deans of the leading medical schools had all written to General Motors head of research, whose name was Charles Kettering, and Alfred Sloan, the chairman of General Motors, asking, in effect, are you guys crazy? We've known lead as poison for 30 years, so why would you add it to gasoline? Because how could that be good? The people at Ethel and General Motors were like, well, prove it. You know, we don't think so. You prove it. Where's your science? And people, you know, were unable to prove it instantly because, of course, nobody had had such a crazy idea before. They had done no science. And, you know, chemistry was a relatively new field. They endeavored, that is, GM, Standard Oil, and DuPont endeavored to fund their own research efforts. And they set up what were basically quack scientists who found that, you know, there was no harm from lead, that lead, high lead, blood lead levels were normal anyway. All of this stuff in the 1960s was debunked the minute they stopped funding the science. And in fact, it was wildly untrue what they had been asserting. It was found in the 1960s that, in fact, the average person's blood lead level was probably 600 times higher than it was in pre-industrial times, and that there were, you know, huge health and public health issues that were existing and in fact growing as more and more cars were sold and more parts of the world became, you know, motorized. Lead was a really big problem. Lead was outlawed from gasoline.
You know, Jamie, I'm going to stop you because you know this history so well.
Okay.
And to me, kind of the story, you might say, of gasoline, how lead got into it, and then bang into the flame retardants is, I think, kind of a metaphor for, you might say, industry and profit and kind of science, all of it intermingling in kind of this process, if you will. And back, you know, with cars, you know, that I've seen some old movies, you know, that people trying to crank the cars because, you know, when they first came on the market, you know, they're pretty exciting and people, you know, it's going to horses and all this kind of stuff. But it was kind of a question even then, what kind of a fuel really should be in these engines? You know, did it have to be petroleum product or would it be better by like an ethanol product? You know, we had all kinds of, you know, corn and other area, you know.
Well, absolutely. In fact, in the 1920s, prior to the introduction of lead, Charles Kettering, the GM researcher, and his assistant Thomas Midgley drove around the country in Chevrolet cars that were powered by a blend of ethanol and gasoline, mostly ethanol. And in fact, they felt like it was going to be difficult to use it as a pure fuel, as an additive, and significantly more than we use even today in our E85, or I mean rather our E10 or E15 fuels, that it was perfect. And they wrote about how it was renewable and clean and it didn't foul the engine. The only problem was is that they couldn't patent it. And so lead became appealing because, and my research in the General Motors archive shows letters between amongst them going like, do you realize that if we sell 10% of the gasoline with lead in it, we'll make this much money. If we sell 20%, we'll make this much money. So they were very much animated by the money and very much, you know, uncaring about the science because everybody was telling them what was wrong with it, and it was exactly what was turned out to be wrong with it after, you know, decades of study. The flame retardant story... If you want me to address
that. No, because I know that it was a lot of it was new to me. I mean, I've always known the dangers, the terrible neurotoxin of lead. And it's been known for hundreds. I mean, the Romans knew how dangerous lead was, et cetera. And as you said, scientists, you know, said, no, you can't do this. But, you know, we've got General Motors. We've got DuPont, the main shareholder of General Motors. And so they want to make money, so you can't use ethanol. And so Kettering then, you know, because cars were hard to start. You could break an arm practically starting them with this crank thing. And so Kettering came up with an electric starter, and this kind of, to me, set the whole thing in play.
This actually, this is an earlier period when he does that. He does that probably 15 years before the lead thing. But it actually, he sets up a company called Delco to make electric starters. And while he's credited with inventing it, my research suggested he actually just bought the patent off of the guy who, in fact, went on to invent the EverReady battery and flashlight. However, Kettering got so wealthy from that, and his company was so successful, that General Motors ended up buying it, and they brought him into the company, and he set up their research lab, and he was failing to come up with anything that was really making them any money, and that made lead attractive in the 1920s after several setbacks. These big players sold out of the lead business in 1962, and that's a longer story, but it has to do with the onset of air pollution regulations, the development of the catalytic converter, which is still our frontline air pollution technology with internal combustion engines. The catalysts are fouled by leaded fuel. So about 9 years after GM sold out of the company to a tiny paper company in Virginia, which was, you know, very, very small, in a what was a fire sale price, about 9 years later, General Motors announces, well, we're going to meet the new Clean Air Act amendments with this thing called the catalytic converter. My research suggests that they knew about it early in the 1960s. They spent a decade lying about it while they were fighting the Clean Air Act, and when they finally lost it, they came out with this thing, and suddenly there was a need for unleaded fuel, which they had been saying was impossible and wouldn't work, but now they were saying it would work. The company that they sold it to, which was the Albemarle Corporation of Richmond, Virginia, and Baton Rouge, Louisiana, were very upset that that had happened, but they soldiered on. They started exporting more and more lead gasoline overseas, but they also sought to invent new uses.
And I'm just going to interrupt you here because you know so much, and most of us don't know this, and so just a real quick update for the listeners so they understand this. That went for the electric starters, and then there was a knock in the engines, and as you said, the gas was so bad, but they really didn't. And then the fight was, was it the electric starter that was causing all these knocks in the engines,
right,
or was it the gasoline? And so then they had to come up with something because it wasn't the starter, and they really had to come up with something that would stop this knock. And so after trying other things, they found lead, and they knew from the get-go that lead was terrible on the engines. It really was wearing them out. It was terrible on the parts, to the point that the military said, hey, we're not going to put this stuff on our planes because it's wrecking them. And so then they had to figure out, and then GM and others in really an interesting thing said, hey, this actually is a good deal because we're making more cars than people want to buy, and this way this will be planned obsolescence. And so things were going along very smoothly until the life expectancy of a car was like 1,500 miles, and they thought, well, we want to do something. And so then they found out that if they put ethyl dibromide or something like that in, that actually would stop some of the corrosive effects. But then this became bad when the Clean Air Act was passed. And so GM is working on stuff that they realize they got to do something. At the same time, they get away from this Ethyl Corporation because they were making more money probably adding this EDB, you know, to the leaded gasoline than they were actually selling cars, or just as much. And so they find this little company. And so they do this huge, you might say, fire sale, and say, hey, you know, this little guy gets the EDB, and they think, oh, okay. But then GM and the others say, hey, we've now got catalytic converters. So there you've got this little company that's stuck with this Ethyl Corporation. What are they going to do to have their money? Okay, now we get to the flame retardants.
So that's where I was saying. So they export more lead overseas, I mean, record amounts, and it's a very high profit item. But they also have huge supplies of bromine, the element bromine, which is extracted from seawater and from salt licks and brine pools, and they have a huge supply of that and the ability to make the chemical that you referred to, ethylene dibromide, EDB. And so they rather than just go, you know, well, let's just get out of this business, they start looking to repurpose these huge amounts of EDB that they have into something else. First, they make it into a grain fumigant. It turns up in breakfast cereals and cake mixes the following year. It's outlawed, one of the few things the government has ever outlawed outright, and as a carcinogen. And then they hit upon the idea of using it as a flame retardant. And they go around the country and the world, ultimately, getting laws passed mandating the use of flame retardants. Just like in the 1920s with lead gasoline, the public health community is up in arms. They say this is really close to PCBs in terms of its chemical formula, and it is probably a carcinogen and maybe even a mutagen, and you shouldn't sell it. Well, they sell it anyway. First science comes in, it proves that it's true, it's both those things, and then they change the formula ever so much, and they've been changing it ever since. So this brings us from the 1970s up to the present day, where it's finally starting to get outlawed in a lot of places, or at least labeled as being in most of the household products you buy, including bedding, children's clothing, carpets, furniture, upholstery foam, but cars, airplanes, electronic equipment, they all have amounts of flame retardant. In fact, it is now so pervasive, like lead, which coated the earth and which never biodegrades, the bromine-based flame retardants have also coated the earth. They will biodegrade eventually, but for now, they're in the blood of 97% of Americans. They're in the breast milk of women in every country on the planet, the blubber of Arctic sea mammals, and it's the same tiny company, Albemarle, that's still selling lead in some places and also now has been selling flame retardant for the last 40 years. So two things that were, you know, among the worst environmental assaults of the 20th century. And there's one family known as the Gottwalds who were in Richmond, Virginia and Baton Rouge who have been selling this. And if you were to go to the macro point here, it's that if you're in a business and, you know, you're a big enough company and you do something terrible, that you not only can get away with it, and you can sort of, stall and stall and stall, but that when you get out of it, nobody's ever going to bring it up again because it's almost like it's considered rude, and the people you sell it to are, you know, sort of lower down on the moral pecking order, but they get away with it, too. The business is grandfathered in, and you can walk sideways away from it when the time is ripe, having earned huge returns in the interim.
And again, we're talking to Jamie Kipman, and you can catch this article in The Nation, Worse Than Lead, but also in the archives. I would strongly suggest you read his first article in 2000 about lead. And Jamie, you really nailed it. Really, I'm serious. I thought following that story, lead and flame retardants, and in the blood of just about everybody, and then with the constant problem of lead, which you can't ever destroy, it's there. You're stuck with it. We've got to figure it out. And I really want to thank you for giving us this time today. And I have to ask, because we've got some car buffs here at the station, what do you drive?
I personally drive a lot of test cars because I write for Automobile Magazine and the New York Times and other publications. So every week they bring a new test car for me to drive, which is pretty great if you love cars. I like older cars, although they're not so clean. I like old MGs and Volvos and Launches and Triumph, so I'm kind of on the lunatic fringe when it comes to what I drive. But, I'm for the next generation of cleaner cars. Recently, I've just been driving the electric Jaguar I-Pace, which I like quite a bit, and I fully expect that at some point we'll all be driving, or most of us will be driving electric cars.
Well, I hope so. Jamie Kipman, wonderful writing. Just, you're a really wonderful historical writer. I really appreciate the time you're giving us. And to me, it's an absolute example of really bad things that have been poorly regulated. And you kind of wonder if they weren't regulated at all. I'm sure we still have the leaded gasoline and the flame retardants. What a battle. Okay, I'm running out of time. So, Jamie Kipman, thank you so much for giving us this time today.
Thank you, Mary.
Bye-bye. And
I posted the article from The Nation on our Facebook page, so you can go there and link to it.
It's troubling and it's fascinating at the same time. And so, Arlene, do you have any announcements?
Just, I'm going to repeat that phone number to call your senators. They've got two issues today that you may want to call them about. And I've learned that you don't give two topics when you call a senator at the same time. You call two different times. And the number at which you can reach any member of the Senate is 202-224-3121. 2-1.
Okay, and you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Just keep it tuned here the whole time, people. And I imagine you've got your eye on some of those hearings. But anyway, take care. Let's put back on Ani DeFranco.
Job is done.